Today is the 4th of Iyar, and officially it should be Yom HaZikaron, the Israel Memorial Day, but in order to preserve Shmiras Shabbos so that people won't be Mechal Shabbos on their way to various ceremonies and so on, it's pushed off. So it's going to be observed tonight and tomorrow. Nevertheless, since we are here and we don't have that problem, as far as I'm concerned, it is Memorial Day, and as a result, I would like to dedicate the shiur to two remarkable individuals, both of whom I had the privilege of knowing very well, and one of whom better known, one less known. The first person I would like to dedicate it to is to the memory of Yedid Nafshi, Rabbi Dr. David Applebaum, Hashem Yikom Damo, David Yaakov Ben Emanuel Halevi, who is best known, unfortunately, for the manner of his death. He was murdered by Hamas terrorists on the eve of his daughter Nava's wedding during the so-called Intifada of a number of years ago. What many people don't know is that David was a person who, among other things, being a tremendous Talmud Chacham and a brilliant doctor, was a devoted heart and soul to the cause of Aliyah. During the two years that became 9 years while my family and I were preparing to return to Eretz Yisrael in the 80s and early 90s, typically there was not a time that David did not come to the United States to work, and that he did not call me either on the way in and on the way out with one specific message: when are you coming? And he did that not just for me. I mean, we were very, very close, thank God. But he did this for hundreds of people, and he was singularly responsible for facilitating the aliyah of literally hundreds of physicians who he ended up funneling through his remarkable and revolutionary medical facility known as Terem, which many of us have either know of or actually have had, for better or for worse, have had to use their services. So that's number one. And number two, he's better known. I would also like to dedicate the shiur to the memory of an uncle of mine. His name was Milton Wolf, Moshe Hillel ben Yosef Reuven, who was a devoted Zionist whose entire life was organized around Zion, and whose the best years of his life were spent in Yerushalayim. And as far as I'm concerned, one of the best years of my life was when he facilitated the first year that our family had the schus of living there in Yisrael, which is about 25 years ago, a little bit more. So, Yehi Nishmatam Baruch. Okay. The topic is a little odd, I admit, but I hope you'll see where it's going. The question of the self-definition of Jews in the exile, vis-a-vis their relationship to their place of residence, and to the anti-Eretz Yisrael, occupies a tremendous and central and massive place in Jewish thought and in halacha. Often, the question, or essentially, the question which is asked is that of why are we still in Golus, why doesn't it end, and why aren't we home? That is not, and you have all kinds of variations of themes. The general themes explaining why Jews are still in exile are either that A, we still have to be punished for whatever purpose we still had to be punished. Reason number two, not unrelated, is to get the Jews to intensify their observance and to be worthy of returning to the land of Israel. And the third one is that evidently God has a pedagogic or educational purpose for us to be here as or lagoyim or whatever case that might be. One thing which I have not discovered, at least not in a normative sense, is the sense of Golus being a mitzvah, and as a result, Jews actually should stay here. But even among Satmar, they still do say that we've sinned, and that's why we're still here. Excuse me. Okay. But that is not the angle that I want to talk about. I want to speak today to the question of the relationship of Jews between Jews and their present geographical location and their relationship to the land of Israel. Toward that end, I would like to commence with a rather odd, unusual, not well-known passage in the writings of Don Yitzchak Abravanel. Don Yitzchak Abravanel, you will recall, came from a distinguished Spanish-Portuguese noble family, a courtier family. In other words, part of that group of aristocratic families in Spain, going all the way back to Abu Yusuf Chasda ibn Shaprut in the 10th century, who, on the one hand, served the kings of Spain, whether first Muslim and then Christian, and then continued, and at the same time, served as the heads of the Jewish community, either in mediating between the communities and the various rulers, and as the sponsors to a significant degree of Jewish scholarship and of Jewish life. Abravanel was a witness to the expulsion from Spain. He actually worked very hard to avert it, and when given the choice to be actually, according to some reports, Don Fernando and Don Isabella, the most Catholic kings of king and queen of Aragon and Castile, respectively, offered him that he didn't have to convert after the expulsion, as opposed to all the other Jews, because they wanted his services. He said, "What am I going to do here with no, you know, that's a no-brainer." So he left. As we'll see, his writings reflect the turmoil of the expulsion from Spain, which for Spanish Portuguese Jews was the psychic equivalent of the destruction of the temple. For that reason, key notes were written in memory of the expulsion and added to the service. To this day, if you go to Spanish Portuguese synagogue downtown, among other places, you will find keynote that were written and added to the liturgy. In the case of the expulsion from Spain, it actually was more appropriate because the last day the Jews were allowed to be in Spain, is more or less one day was actually Tisha B'Av, because the end of August was the last day. I travel a lot in Europe. One of the typical experiences that you have is when you go to the Alhambra in Granada, which is probably one of the most stunning architectural buildings in the world. It was the palace of the king of Granada, the last Muslim king to actually be conquered by the Spanish as part of the reconquest of Spain called the Reconquista. And you walk around this place with the grounds and everything else, and it's just absolutely stunning. It's breathtaking. And you get to the throne room, which is the center of the building, and your eyes pop out from its grandeur, and then you remember that it was in that room, almost the minute that Ferdinand and Isabella conquered it, that they issued the declaration of expulsion, which is a typical example of the multi-level nature of the Jewish encounter with places in Golos. Places that are absolutely stunningly beautiful hide behind themselves less than happy memories if you're a Jew. I had a similar thing last week. Just a week ago when I was coming back after Pesach, one of my areas of specialty is the Jews of Italy. And I had a layover in Rome. And I was thinking of taking a train to go to the ghetto for lunch because the airline food wasn't mio de amma. So I said Sunday morning, what could happen? What could be going on? I'll take a cab. I'll have lunch and I'll go. And I'll come back to the airport and come back to New York. For some reason, I decided to have a cup of coffee. Well, for some reason, I always drink a cup of coffee. But so I went to have a cup of coffee beforehand, and I saw on the screen that all of St. Peter's Square and the entire Vatican area was full with 1.5 million people because they had the beatification of John Paul II. I said, forget it, I'm not going. I mean, because the ghetto is right across the Tiber from the Vatican. I'm assuming the traffic is going to be. I mean, traffic in Rome is always bad. This is going to be awful. But as I was sitting in the terminal, it hit me once again The contrast, St. Peter's is a brilliantly beautiful area. Right at the edge of the Vatican complex, on the far side of the Tiber, on the other side of the Tiber, are the Vatican office buildings. Next to the Vatican office buildings, in Piazza di San Pantaleo, is an area called Piazza di Fiori, the Plaza of Flowers. And in the center, during the morning, they have an open-air market. In the afternoon, they have their cafes. It's right on the other side of Piazza Navona. It's a wonder. It's a jewel of the city of Rome. And people sit there, many Jews, many observant Jews sit there, and they drink coffee or whatever, without knowing that it was on that spot that the papacy loved to burn copies of the Talmud. From 1555 on, hundreds and thousands of copies of the Gemara were set on fire and destroyed in an effort to destroy the Jewish life of the Jews who lived in the ghetto, not more than a couple 100 meters or so from there, maybe 200 meters from there. Again, you have this dual kind of sensitivity with that regard. And the same can be said of all kinds of places, whether you're talking about the Hôtel des Vosges in Paris, which is one of those beautiful palaces in France where they burnt the Talmud in 1242, and other places where they burnt people. This is the nature of the bifurcated kind of, or multi-leveled and multivalence experience. In any event, so Abravanel left Spain, and in his writings, he gives voice to the kind of emotions, the kind of turbulent emotions that he felt on the occasion of the expulsion, and what it meant for a Spanish Jew to undergo them. I'd like to begin, therefore, I've given you the pasuk he bases it on. This is from his commentary on Yeshayahu Mem Gimel Amud Vav. I will apologize. I actually should have given you the page number, because one of the things about Abravanel was that he was incredibly verbose, and as a result, it's hard to find. It's not easy to find things, but this is not that long a comment that he has here, so it shouldn't be too hard to find in the standard editions of Abravanel. He writes as follows. He's talking about the exodus from Egypt and the taking the Jews out of Egypt and what that meant and so on and so forth. And that leads him to discuss the various expulsions that had occurred in contemporary memory. Let's start. Ubazek kulo ba'omro. Ubazek kulo ba'omro. Natati b'perach Mitzrayim. He puts the pasuk above. I have given the Jews over to the difficult labor of Egypt. Klomar shahoshiyam migalutam. I have actually saved them from their golos. And so, and skip a little bit. I don't want to take whatever. Second line. On ra'inu be'inenu. We saw with our own eyes, Shehiir Hashem at Ruach Malchei Arzot HaMizrach. That, come again? What did I say? Hamara? What did I say? Oh, I'm sorry. See what I said? Libi BaMizrach today, Vani B'Sof Ma'arav. Thank you. Heir Hashem, that's actually my Facebook status today. Shehiir Hashem at Ruach Malchei Arzot HaMa'arav. God inspired the kings of the western countries, Ligaresh Marzotam Kol HaYudim, to expel all of the Jews, Hashochnim Ba'arzotam, who were living in their lands. V'itchila Gevush HaRishon, and he began the first expulsion, Me'ik Tseharet, at an island at the edge of the world, Hanikra Inglaterra. What's that? England, okay? Shegeresh HaMelech Otam Gevush Kolel Umuchlat. He absolutely expelled them. Bishnat 5,000 be'esrim lebriyat haolam. He's actually wrong here. He has it down as 1260. It actually was 1290. Maybe he was slightly dyslexic. I don't know. But that's true. Edward I expelled all the Jews of England in 1290. Jews were not legally allowed to be back in England until 1750. And even then, it was something of a question. In other words, when Shakespeare wrote The Merchant of Venice, he never seen a Jew. When Mallory wrote The Jew of Malta, he had never seen a Jew. When Chaucer wrote The Prioress's Tale about the blood libel of St. William William of Norwich, he may have seen a Jew, but the Jew was a Mishuman. Okay? So, In any event, and also I will tell you, after having been in England in December for Limud, there are large sectors of England which it is still no Hargenigan for a Jew to be. In any case, it's 1290. V'hayusham kihilot gdolot v'atzumot, and there were great and large communities there. Ubao lishkon b'tzorfat. So they all moved to France. The reason why they moved to France historically is because they were French Jews who moved to England. Anyways, many of you may know that, in fact, the official language of the French court until the middle of the 15th century was French because of the Norman conquest. I mean, so, in fact, there was a time in which, there were times in which the King of England actually controlled more France than indeed the King of France. If you're interested in seeing an interesting part of that, you can watch, you can download The Lion in Winter with Peter O'Toole and Catherine Hepburn. That is against that background. In any event. Okay? Shayushama Mimekenden. They were there from time immemorial. Acharkach, nevertheless, after that, Gamalehem Avrakoski Hilod Rabot. Gamken b'shanim b'shayim o'shalosh pamin geresh melech tzorfat et kol ha-yudim asher tachat memshalto. The king of France also, on a number of occasions, expelled the Jews of his domain. U'begerush ha-hayah b'imei Rav Levi ben Gershom hayu kiflayim ki'atzeim im Mitzrayim. That at the time, that two or three times that the king of France expelled the Jews, that's true. There's some debate of whether it was two or three. Philip the Fair expelled the Jews in 1306. They were expelled by default, it seems, in 1327, and then they were called back, stupidly, in my opinion, and my other area of expertise is French Jewry. They came back, and they were finally expelled in 1394. One of the more interesting ironies of history is when there's a description of a scene in which the formulators of the Declaration des droits humains, or des hommes, the Declaration of Rights of Man, that was the ultimate statement of the French Revolution. They were talking about liberté, fraternité, égalité, until somebody even raised his head and said, what about the Jews? And everybody was stunned because they didn't talk about Jews at all. Because at the time, there were no Jews in France. There were Jews under French rule in Alsace-Lorraine, but they weren't allowed to live in France, and that raised a whole kind of series of questions. Again. Come again? 1789, there were no Jews in France. Jews were not allowed to be French. The best-known Jew who lived in France in the interim was one Meshumet whose name was Nostradamus, who used Kabbalah, I'm not going to say Kabbalah, used Kabbalah to write his books of centuries, but that's another story also. Anyways, 1394, no more Jews. Okay? And he claims that there were 600,000, what do you say? Kiflaim Kiyotzei Mitzrayim, 1.2 million Jews who were expelled. Ubishnar Kamesh Talafimu Meyava Chamishim Lechamisha Lebriyat HaOlam Haya Gerusha Acharon Lechol Kolam. That's 1394. And then we'll skip. Then he said Jews were thrown out of Savoy and Lombardy and Tuscany and Germany and Asia. And then he says, finally, this is the important part, Bishnat Matayim Lechamishim Ushnayim, in the year 1492, Heir Hashem and Ruach Malchei Sfarad, God inspired the kings of Spain, to expel from their lands all of the Jews. There were 300,000, he says. They went in all kinds of directions. Okay, the kulam avru keneged Eretz Yisrael. And they all went in the direction of Eretz Yisrael, because you couldn't go west, right? At the time, don't forget, in 1492, we didn't know there was anything west of, because you know who left at the same time as the Columbus set sail, and don't ask me whether he was Jewish or not, I was fine. Columbus set sail around the same time as the last Jews were leaving. So everybody moved eastward. They moved to Italy, they moved to Poland, that's how my Spanish ancestry comes. A lot of us, there were a lot of Polish Eden whose name is Barbanel, Agav. For that reason, there's a very famous Litvish family, the Don Yichya family. The original family was Ibn Yahya, because they also came from Spain. They are people, they move. Then they move to Egypt, and they move to, but all in the direction of Eretz Israel, he says. Okay? And on that he says, and Abravanel sees in that, and he says also the Anusim, the Converzi also moved to Eretz Israel, and in fact, it's true. A significant part of the population of Eretz Israel, especially in Tzfat in the 16th century, was made up of Anusim who came back to Judaism, and it was at their urging that the attempt was made by Rabbi Yaakov Beirav to restore the Sanhedrin. They pushed it because the Gemara says that, well, the Gemara, the Torah says if you worship a Avodah Zarah, then you're Chayev Kares. The Mishnah says at the end of Makkos that if a Bezdin of Smuchim, of people at the Smicha, the old time Smicha, not the not what this distinguished institution gives out, but the old time Smicha, which has the same authority to instill the death penalty and all kinds of other things, if you receive lashes, if you receive Malkos administered by that such a court, then that takes off the Kares. So this massive group of Konverzi urged Rabbi Yaakov Beirav to take advantage of an opening that was left him by Maimonides to restore smicha, to allow them to have a kind of penance to get on with their lives after they had been forced to worship idolatry in the form of Yashka and all the rest of the Heilige Familie. Okay. So he's historically correct here, and then he goes on and he quotes Pesukim to show that he sees in this movement eastward the fulfillment of a divine plan. Now, at first blush, this is not so striking, a statement. Any good B'nai Akiva Shliach would be able to come up with this kind of speech, especially today or tomorrow. But we're actually talking about Don Yitzchak Abravanel. Alright? So, in order to be able to understand just how powerful this statement is, we need to look at two other sources. Look at source number one, number three rather, just an example of where he got the word Heir, to arouse the spirit, to inspire. It's a pasuk at the end of the Divrei Hayamim. There are other. There's a parallel in the beginning of Ezra too. Ubishnat achat is the very end of Divrei Hayamim. Ubishnat achat lekoresh melech paras lechlo dvar Hashem b'fi Yirmiyahu. Heir Hashem et ruach koresh melech paras vayaver kol bechol malchuto v'gam b'michtav leimur ko amar koresh melech paras. Kol mamlachot ha'aretz natan li Hashem Elokei Hashamayim, v'u pakar alai levnot bo bayit Yerushalayim Asher b'Yehuda, mibachem mikol amo Hashem Elokav imo v'yal. This was the verb that was used by the author of Divrei Hayamim and by Ezra to describe Cyrus, who mandated and ordered the return of the Jews from Zion. He was the Eved Hashem who, in fact, facilitated the return to Zion, the Tzion, the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash, and the functional end, at least officially, of the exile from Babel. Okay. Cyrus is the restorer of the kingdom. He's considered to be a very positive figure in Jewish history. Interestingly, apropos, I don't mean to not drop names, but it happens to be a friend of mine. Ambassador Dr. Michael Oren wrote this famous book, Piety and Power and Something, 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 American in the Middle East. So he told me a story. I don't remember if it's in the book, because I'll admit I didn't finish the book. But he told me, when we were both fellows at the Shalane Institute, he told me a story that when somebody came up after the state had been established, and said, you know, you had a tremendous contribution to the establishment of the State of Israel. Truman was totally taken aback. He said, what do you mean, had a contribution? I'm Cyrus. See, we forget that Truman was a really strong Bible Belt Baptist. And if there's one thing that Bible Belt Baptists know, it's their Bible. Alavai, we should all know Tanakh as well as they know Bible. Okay? I was recently, I don't remember which direction I was flying, I've been doing it too much. But in one of the flights over back and forth between here and home, I was sitting with a bunch of Christian pilgrims, and they were chazering in for Tanakh. They had this, like we have Daf Yomi, so they had finished the Bible in like a month. And this woman was, I don't know if she was having a test or something, but she was taking notes or whatever, but she could recite, man, it was very impressive. As I said, Alavai, we should know Tanakh as well as they do. In any event, so it's one thing to say about Cyrus, but about Don Fernando and Isabella? Edward the First? I mean, when I was in Westminster Abbey, I wanted to brech when I saw his mausoleum. Or Philip the Fourth, Philip the Fair. It was a miesdige mensch. And the Dukes of Savoy and Toscana, trust me, there were nothing to whatever. In fact, I was in when I took to Granada, to Spain, and I was in Granada. We had a two hour sort of like break before we were going back to Barcelona, and I decided, well, you know, I want to go see their mausoleum, and they were closed. So I waited. Finally, I walked in, and they said, well, it'll cost you €2 to go in, and I also got sick. I said, I'm not spending €2 to go see it, to spend money to see them. Forget it. So I walked out, and I was in. These are Rishoyim, guys. These are evil people. And nevertheless, Abravanel says, God inspired them. They become Cyrus. What? That's fighting the words. That's a very strong statement. It's even stronger, and it's even stronger than you might think. Move over. Where are we? Here we are. Number 7. Obviously, number 2 was written by Abravanel after the expulsion. Number 7 was also written after that, but it's a totally different document. This is a passage from one of the most remarkable things ever written by a Jew, in my opinion. Certainly by a major intellectual figure. This is an addendum that Abravanel wrote to the Book of Malachim, to tell people what happened to some of the Jews after the Babylonians destroyed the temple. And he starts off with a whole discussion. I didn't bring the whole thing. It's worth reading, but I didn't bring it because we don't have time. He starts by, he basically tells us that there was one of the people that Nebuchadnezzar had a lot of allies. And among the allies was a Greek general whose name was Pyrrhus, by some Pyrrhic victories. And that Pyrrhus had us, and I forgot about the Yichus. And Pyrrhus had a son-in-law, and the son-in-law's name was Hercules. And Hercules had fought at Troy. The history's all off, but all right. Hercules has fought at, Hercules didn't exist. Hercules fought at Troy, and he brought Pyrrhus, and Pyrrhus helped Nebuchadnezzar, and Hercules had conquered Spain, and he'd left it to Pyrrhus was his nephew. Sorry. And Pyrrhus had left it to his nephew, and Pyrrhus then had a son-in-law whose name was Isfahan, and he left Spain to Isfahan and his daughter, whose name is not mentioned in the text. And that is why the area of the Iberian Peninsula is called Hispania, because it's named after this guy Isfahan, according to him. Okay? And this Isfahan, acting on his father, you always go into your father-in-law's business, don't you? That's the deal. Right? So he went into his father-in-law's business, he became the king of Spain, and he inherited a whole bunch of these, of high-class aristocratic Jewish prisoners. And he brought them all to, Eretz Yisrael. And that's where we pick up the action here. Number 7. Unisa'a Pyrrhus shaya gam ken yisarei Yavan. Pyrrhus, the son-in-law, was the nephew, was also from the nobles of Greece, who Ayah Bechor Bias Rishon, and he was there assisting Nebuchadnezzar at the time. The Hevi Misham b'nei Yehuda u'bin Yamin u'mishimin u'me'alaviyim u'vekon. He got a good chunk of Jews from Judea, from Benjamin, from Simon, because they were the ones who were living there, and Levites and Kohanim. Asher hayub Yerushalayim amrav shabau imod b'yotzonam. Notice, he says, they came with him of their own will. Okay, I think it's one of these, yes, I'll come, I absolutely want to. But they came of their own will, right? By the way, following other sources in the earlier period, Abravanel lives in the late 15th century, but the Sephardic Jews, the Spanish Portuguese Jews, be careful, he's not the same as the Jews in Iraq and so on, different community, not better, not worse, it's different. They had adopted a line from the prophet Ovadia, that they represented Galut Yerushalayim Asher B'Sfarad, the exile of Jerusalem, which is in Spain, and they considered themselves to be descended from the upper classes only. All right? That's why every second Sephardic speaker claims descent from David HaMelech. Oh yeah, Gahata Sach Viber says possible. David HaMelech, I mean. But anyways, so they came of their own will. Vayivyein B'derech Hayam. He brought them by sea, Ba'aniyot, I'm sorry, this is a function of the bad optical character recognition program that they use in HebrewBooks.org, which otherwise is a wonderful thing. Ba'aniyot, l'malchut Svarad, he brought them to Spain, v'yoshivei mishnei mechozot, he settled them in two areas. Ha'echad hu mechoz ha'nikra hayom Andalusia. It's that area which is, till this day, called Andalusia, which is in southern Spain, which actually was the center of Jewish population. By the way, ironically, one of the reasons called Al-Andalusia, a V fell out, because it was the area that was the center of the Vandal kingdom of Rome, of Spain in the 5th century. It's really supposed to be Al-Vandalusia. But anyways, in the Arabic, it's called Al-Andalus. By the way, in the Hezbollah and Hamas literature, there are two areas where they are, that they dream of constantly talk about reconquering. One of them is Palestine, and the other one is Al-Andalus, which is probably one of the reasons why, about 2 years ago, when there was a border dispute between, a small border incident between Morocco and Spain, that the Spaniards, it didn't go in the papers, but the Spaniards actually mobilized most of their armed forces. Okay? The Spanish government mobilized, had a partial mobilization of the army over a border incident between them and Morocco, because. In any event, where are we? Okay, so what was Andalusia? Now watch this. Be'ir achat shahaya b'yamim ha'hem, ir ve'ein b'Yisrael. It was a city, a mother in Israel. Sarati b'mdinot. Hello, what city in the world bears the title Sarati b'mdinot? Yerushalayim, Echa Yashva Badad Hayir, Rabati Am, Sarati Bamdinot. The mistress, the leader, the most noble, the most distinguished of all cities. Abindina in this case probably means city. Vayikru'u Otaha Yehudim Lusena. They called it Lusena. Vegam Hayom Nikre Kein. It's still called Lusena. You can still go visit it in Andalusia. Now watch this. Va'amru Aleha Haguyim. And the nation said regarding Andalusia, or perhaps just Lucena, Lihyot Avir Haaretz Hahi Matzach Venaki Meod Meod. Okay? The air is particularly good, it is particularly clean, it is particularly rarefied. Okay? What does that invoke? Avira de Eretz Israel Machkim. That the very air of the land of Israel makes you smart. I think it's because if you live in Israel and you smoke there, it just shows that you're smart. So you breathe the air. Okay. Well, smart would not to worship, either worship Avodah Zarah or to kill each other and get exiled in the first place. That was stupid, number one. But yeah, you can get smart afterwards. Lihya, okay. V'ulai, he says, and he speculates of Ravana. It may very well be that the Jews who he assumed founded Lusena. Called it Lusena. Lihyota kiluz asher be'eretz Kanaan, because it reminded them, or it was the equivalent of Luz in the land of Israel. Muchana linvua, prepared or able to inspire prophecy. Where is the city of Luz? No. Beit El. Says Yaakov. Okay, so that's number one. So Luz, Lusena can be Shara Shamayim, Borough Park, can be Shara Shamayim, and what? Nivua. What is the thing we all learned in high school or before about the nature of prophecy? Prophecy can only occur in the land of Israel. And who's the big exception? Nope. Yonah's not a problem. He went on a little teal. No. Yechezkel spent his entire prophetic career was in Babel. But overwhelmingly his nevuah is referred to Eretz Yisrael, so that's how I explained it. But in general, there's a dogmatic position that nevuah is restricted to the land of Israel. And here comes up Ravanel and says that they called it Luz because you could be a prophet there. This is probably not unrelated to the fact that the Spanish Jews were very impressed with their capacity to write poetry. And poets, prophets, it goes together. That is the upshot, in fact, of a long essay that was written in the 12th century by Moshe Ibn Ezra, say, why are the Spanish Jews so superior to all other Jews that we know how to write poetry? And among the things he writes is the fact that we come from King David and so on. In fact, Samuel Ibn Nagrela, Shmuel and Agid, says, Ani David Bidori, I am the David of my generation, so just like he wrote Tillim, I write poetry. And three of his books are Ben Tehillim, Ben Mishle, and Ben Kohelet. Okay. By the way, he is absolutely right about... Yes? Absolutely. You beat me to the punch. Very good. Excellent. Do you hear what she's saying? She's saying that, in fact, what the upshot is, that at least for the short and the medium term, for the foreseeable future, Spain was an Eretz Israel substitute. Am I summing up what you said? Okay. Mm-hmm. Correct. So it's not Gaulist. It's not Gaulist. Okay. Well, let's not draw a conclusion. Let's stick to where we are right now. Okay. The causal, I will have to hold off on the causal comment. Okay. Next. All right. Now, by the way, his comment about Lucena being a Yiddish agent is absolutely correct. It was the center of Jewish scholarship for many years. The Rif wrote his halachas there. Reb Yehosef Ibn Migash, who was the teacher of the Rambam's father, held court there. Reb Yudah Levi was the yeshiva secretary there. And there were periods of time in which there were only Jews there. We know this because in the 9th century, the Jews of Lucena wrote a letter to Rav Sar Shalom Gaon in Baghdad and asked him, how do you make an Erev here? And he said, it's a cinch, because there's no Goyim in your town. You don't have to worry about Goyim. You don't have to hire anybody, you don't have to pay them off, you don't have to buy their Erev. No, just close the gates, you're fine. It's a Jewish city. It's Borough Park. It's the 5 towns. Stone, Amora, no, forget about it. That's not nice. That's not nice. That's not nice. I take that back. Don't put that on the table. All right. And then he says as follows, V'amachos ha-shini haya v'eretz Tolitula. And the second region is called Toledo. V'yidemen, it seems to me, sh'ayudim karu shem ha'ir Tolitula, which is the way the Jews used to call Toledo, they called it Toledo, al shem ha-tziltul sh'asu b'boam Yerushalayim shama, because of the various peregrinations that they had to go through getting there. By the way, you have to know something. Toledo is an ancient Spanish city. It was the capital of the Visigothic Kingdom of Spain. It was the aim of every Christian king to reconquer it. It's the sacred city. The main cathedral of Toledo is a significant building in Spanish architecture, in Spanish history, in Spanish mentality. In fact, one of the first churches to be refurbished in the 15th century, according to the dedicatory plaque, with money that unexpectedly came our way in 1495, okay, was the Toledo Cathedral. And then he goes on. He has other ones. There's a city named after Ashkelon and so on and so forth. Everything named after. And he says, why were they all named after places in Eretz Israel? Ulai hayu haharim hahen vidmutam domim el haharim asher hayu be'eretz Israel ukrovim elea velachen kraum bishmam. And he says in this question, there were other cities of which I'm not aware. In other words, hold on a second. In other words, it is patently clear that the Spanish Jews saw Spain as a Eretz Israel substitute. In fact, there were in the late 12th century, Rabbi Avraham Ibn Daoud. Would you like to bring have your daughters bring home a guy whose name is Ibrahim Ibn Daoud? You'd probably flip out, right? Ibrahim Ibn Daoud. It's the writer, the first writer. Listen, Musa bin Maimun bin Abdallah is probably not going to make a lot of raise a lot of eyebrows either, except for. Who's Musa bin Maimun bin Abdallah? The Rambam. That's why the Rambam's grandson was named Ovadia, because Abdullah is Ovadia. By the way, that's Rav Ovadia's original name, is Abdullah, because he's named after Chacham Abdullah Somech, who was the chief rabbi of Baghdad. Yeah, you have a question. I'm sorry, it's hard for me to hear. Okay. The center. Okay. Alright, so if you realize, if you think about, according to Ibn Daud, the Mashiach is first going to come to Spain and then go to Eretz Yisrael. And if you think that's a bizarre statement, there are people who think that the Mashiach will first come to a somewhat lower class neighborhood in Brooklyn first, and then go there. No joke. In Lubavitch messianology, 770 is going to be picked up and moved. You've never been to Lubavitch steeple and see 770 sitting on Harabayan? Okay, I actually davened in I ended up in a shtibul where on the parochet there was an embroidered picture of the reconstruction of the base that makes it look like, and behind it looming over it is 770. All right, so but it's the same mindset. That's the point. I'm not giving an anti-Lubavitch speech here. I'm trying to point out that you have something have a very similar kind of mindset here. Okay. In one case, it's a discursive description. In another case, it's a visual description. Same deal. All right. So if you consider Don Yitzchak Abravanel's description of this formative legend of Spanish self-definition, you begin to understand the break. What it took for him to say that God inspired the kings of Spain to expel the Jews. This was not just a matter of, oh good, he threw us out of Agolas. He threw us out of Eretz Israel. Okay? More than that, he smashed our dreams to smithereens. In number 10 and 11, again, we don't have much time. In number 10 and 11, I brought you, and this is a long time perception. In number 10 and 11, 10 is a passage, selection from the last two paragraphs of the Kuzari of Rabbi Yehuda Levi. And number 11 is a not sufficiently known poem of his, a letter to a friend. They're both in response to Halevi's decision to go to Eretz Israel. In number 10, basically, Halevi admits that he was a failure. Because the Khazar king, after studying with the Chaver all those years, didn't understand why Halevi would want to go to Eretz Israel. So he's got everything here. You could be Sherman Mitzvahs and Torah and this and that. What do you need to go to Eretz Israel for? And he just says goodbye. In number 11 is a letter that he wrote to a friend, in which he says, you don't understand, because his friends thought he was crazy. His friends thought he was nuts. Why are you leaving Spain? And he ends by saying something really striking in the four lines from the bottom. Re'ena gam re'e dodi, see my beloved, v'havein. Understand what I'm doing. V'sur mi mokshim tzinimu pachim, from empty obstacles. V'alti shi'acha chokma yevanit, and don't be deceived by the universalist elements of Greek philosophy. Asher e'la pri ki im prachim. It's a beautiful thing. It gives flowers, but no fruit. It's sterile. Don't sophisticate yourself to death and think that this is it. Okay, but he was the exception. The passage from Elohim was the norm among Spanish Jews. And you have to try to imagine Abravanel, who was the representative, the scion of all that Spanish culture stood for, by the way, which makes us possible today. We could not be speaking the Hebrew language in either in the land of Israel or anywhere else were it not for the efforts of the grammarians and the poets and the philologians and the exegetes of Spain. Ben Yehuda was made possible by Yehuda Chiyuj and by Yonah ibn Janach and by David Kimchi and all the rest of them. Just, you know, never mind the Rambam. Imagine this institution without the Rambam. I can't. Okay. That's one model. I'm at home. Yes, I'm in Golis. Someday the Mashiach will come. But in the meantime, if I feel good here, why should I go anywhere else? By the way, interestingly, this was not just a Spanish business. If you carefully read the last two letters of the 19 letters of Rav Shamshon Ufoil Hirsch, he gives a very weak lip service to the Geula, and he talks about the building up of Jewish people through Bildung, through Menschbildung, in the context of the height of Deutsche Hochkultur, of German high culture, and the creation of what he called the Yisrael Mensch, the ultimate Jew. Okay. That's one model. In the 10 minutes that I have left, I want to look at the other another model. Now, this is not, as I said, I brought in Rav Hirsch because I didn't want to make it a Sephardic Ashkenazic thing. However, among non-Spanish Jews, and here I include the Edot HaMizrach, there's a totally different take. Let's take a look at number 5. Number 5 is a Gemara in Nedarim, I promise I'm Kalachim. The Gemara talks about the fact that if tax collectors, self-appointed or otherwise, whether they have Tony Soprano or they come from the IRS, if they come to illegally take property that belongs to Jews, you can actually take an oath which is doesn't volunteer a lot of information. Okay, so we put it that way. And then in the Gemara, Shmuel famously says, "Dina mochus dina." You have to obey the laws of the country. You have to pay your taxes, or you should have. It's already May 8th, but you know, okay. Okay, okay. Whenever you pay them, they take it. But okay, take a look at number 6. All right. So the Gemara says it depends. You can fake it with a guy who comes with an open-ended, just going to collect money unended. But if somebody has a real tax bill from the government, that you have to pay. Because the other guy, the first guy, is not legitimate. Notice what he says. If a guy comes, some guy comes to collect taxes for the king, and he says he can take whatever he wants, shelo kedinu osed, that's illegal. Vedina de malchusadina, true. Aval gazela de malchusalavina. When the government comes to steal from you, and it's even according to its own laws, not, you know, illegal, that you don't have to pay. Now watch what he says. Upershu batosfus. The Balia Tosfus said, this is Rabbi Lazar, b'shem Rabbi Lazar Mimetz, who was one of the premier students of Rabbeinu Tam. The davka b'malchei umos ha'olam, that this rule of adina lachus adina applies only when it comes to non-Jewish kings. Why? Dematzi amarlehu, because he could always say to them, imlo ta'asu mitzvati or mitzvotai agaresh etchem shaha'aretz shelohi. Jews are always living on borrowed time. You have to do what he says because the land belongs to him. So he can do whatever he wants. And if he wants to expel you, he has every single right to do so. All right? And then there's a lot of the halakhic arguments afterwards. In other words, strikingly, in all of the discussions of the complaints of Jews and the wake of expulsions, they complained about cruelty, they complained about suffering, they complained about having of rapine, they complained about all kinds of things. No one ever raised said that the non-Jewish authorities don't have the right to expel the Jews. Because the one thing throughout history that the Jews and the Christians believed in or agreed on was that the Jew doesn't belong. The Jews agreed, we belong in Eretz Israel. The non-Jews agreed, they belong in Eretz Israel, except the Jews were forever barred from Eretz Israel for having rejected rejected a certain individual who I should mention in Shulman. This is a Shulman. Yeah. Okay. All right? Now. And that is the that's the bottom line. It is for that reason, by the way, that reformist and assimilationist leaders of the Jewish people, when they decided to denationalize Judaism, started by formulating themselves in that regard. So therefore, how do you say a Jewish citizen of Germany? Deutsche Bürger Mosaische Glaubens. A German citizen of the Mosaic faith. When Isaac Mayer Wise started the Reform movement in the 19th century in the United States, he announced, America is our Palestine, and Cincinnati is our Jerusalem. Now, I've been in both places. With all due respect to Cincinnati, not exactly the same thing. But the point is they had to make a conscious effort to redefine your definition, redefine your identity in terms of a new place to detach yourself from what had been the consistent position of the Jews. That finds expression, by the way. Now, it's not just a matter of I don't belong here, I belong there. Take a look at number 8. Number 8 is the famous Bnei Akiva Rashi. Okay, God created the world to give... I mean, the truth of the matter is, considering what's going on in the world, it's like it could be written yesterday, that the Jews are accused of stealing Eretz Israel, and we had no right to take it from the Seven Amamim, or from the Palestinians, or from this one, or from that one. And instead, you know, so we said God created the world, and it's ours. Finished. Okay. If it were written today, so I would understand. But Rashi wrote this paragraph in the 11th century. Rashi, realistically, didn't expect to be living in Israel at the end of his life, which is when he wrote this. And in addition, he pegs it to the beginning of his parish on Chumash. Think about that. The whole Torah was to tell us that we have a right to Eretz Israel. Mefarshim for hundreds of years after that say, what happened to Rashi? What's the matter with him? The Ramban says, what do you mean? What are you talking about? I mean, yes, it's true. And at the end, the Ramban went to Eretz Yisrael. But, you know, you'll learn all kinds of stuff from Bereishis, how to be a mensch, how this. The Netziv says it. I mean, you could write an entire seminar paper on responses to this Rashi by people saying there's a lot more to Bereishis all the way up to HaKodesh Hazeh Lachem besides the title deed besides the Merkas HaRab Chagiga for Yom HaTzmaut. I mean, there's more to it. So instead of let's ask the other question, what's bothering Rashi? Why would a person living in Troyes in the 11th century with no immediate prospects of moving to Israel going to write something like this? Rashi was a very smart man. Rashi is the most published Hebrew book after the Gemara and the Chumash. So, how come? What's bothering Rashi, to use the Chabalev, which is famous question? Well, what historical event was he witness? The Crusades, in which what happened? The two superpowers, Christendom and Islam, the Dar al Islam and Christendom, are fighting over in a war that at least the Christians saw as one of bringing in the second coming of that is other individual, are fighting over a piece of land that what? Does not, as far as we're concerned, does not belong to either of them. And what can the Jew do about it? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. He's helpless, he's got no swords, he's got no army, and he's watching the land be conquered. Now,
What does that tell you? So Rashi's writing in response. But what to whom is he writing in response? It's blatantly apparent that Rashi would not have done something so extreme as to say that all of Sefer Bereishis and the first chunk of Sefer Shmos were added to the Chumash only to secure and to emphasize our title, our absolute title, inalienable title to Eretz Yisrael, if it weren't for the fact that he was filling a definite, immediate need. In other words, the sight of the Crusaders marching through France to conquer the land of Israel from the Muslims threatened to demoralize the Jews whose lives were not exactly perfect. Anyways, keep in mind this is this time of the year that we talk and we think about the attacks of the Crusaders on the homeland of Ashkenazic Jewry in Mainz and Speyer and Köln and Worms and Regensburg and Trier and Halle and not Halle and elsewhere. But what does that tell you about there? So we say, never mind. Have emunah. It's still ours. But what does that tell you about the way the Jews organize their reality? It means that as far as their self-definition was concerned, they didn't belong where they lived. It's the diametric opposite. The diametric opposite of the position of the contemporary Spanish and Portuguese Jews. More than that, number nine, in my I'll have to refer you to my previous Midrash Yom Rishon. They experienced, in that talk, I tried to show that when Jews would walk into shul, they were not just in shul; they were transported to Eretz Yisrael. And they saw the shul as a portal to the Beis Hamikdash, which is an emotional reality, a religious reality, no less tangible than sticks and stones. Number four, is something of a Spanish response to Rashi. Rabbeinu Bachya ben Asher was a Talmud of the Ramban. In his commentary on the on Chumash, on the pasuk of Beru Kol Amei Haaretz Ki Shem Hashem Nikra Elecha V'Yaru Mimcha, that all the nations of the world will see that God's name is called on you and they will fear you, makes the following comment: Mishehu Eved Basar Echad Misarei Hamelech Ein Ma'alato Gdola Kol Kach Ki Elu Ki Ilu Haya Avdo Shel Melech. The person who is the servant of the minister to the king is not as distinguished as the servant of the king. Now, in this context, it means serving God. But the truth of the matter is that Spanish Jews said, look it, we're senators, we're congressmen, we have access to the president, to the king, we have access to the court. We're amazing. That was 120 years before the expulsion. I asked God why. So when Ravanel comes and he says, God inspired the kings to expel the Jews. Among Italian Jews, French Jews, English Jews, German Jews in the Middle Ages, it was understood. We don't belong. It's dangerous to feel we belong. Abravanel grew up thinking, we belong. We're Spanish. We've been here from the time of Bais Rishon, before Jesus was crucified. Before Jesus was crucified, we were not even responsible for his death. We were here before the Vandals and the Visigoths and this one and that one. We are more Spanish than the Spanish.
It helped like whatever bunkus. In Hebrew you say kosot ruach. I don't have to call them in English.
When push came to shove, Abravanel was forced to look at the bitter reality and to say, God inspired the kings to teach the Jews of the West the lesson and to push them towards Israel. I leave you with a challenge. I hear a lot of people, while I'm living here this semester, say, it's not for me, it's too hard. How many people ate chametz because it was too hard to get matzah? How many people didn't put on tefillin because it was too hard to put on tefillin? How many people didn't give up a job? They didn't take a job because they required Shmir Shabbos. Since when do we decide that doing a mitzvah is optional because it's too hard? We have to make a decision. Every Jew in America, every Jew in the world has to decide. Do you want to go with Rashi? Or you want to be Tzibrachan like your brother now? I made my choice because I'm convinced that your future depends on us and not the other way around. So I will adopt the example of my much bemoaned, much lamented, and much beloved friend, Harav Hagaon of David Halevi Applebaum, and ask everyone who is here and also who hears this online, what are you doing here? Yom HaZikaron Tov, and Chag HaTzmaut Sameach.